Hello and welcome, everyone. My name is John Marks, and I am the editor of CopsAlive.com. Cops Alive was founded to help police officers and other law enforcement professionals plan for happy, healthy, and successful lives both on the job and beyond the job. And we do that by assembling as much useful information as we can on the Cops Alive website and through the training programs just like this one that are hosted both on the telephone and on the internet. Today's guest is Robert E. Douglas, Jr., the Executive Director of the National Police Suicide Foundation here in the United States. Robert is a retired police agent from the Baltimore City Police Department. He served as chaplain for the Baltimore City FOP Lodge No. 3 from 1988 until 2002 and is currently serving as the chaplain for the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in both their Baltimore and Washington, D.C. field offices. During his time in these positions, he became aware of the need for assistance for police and emergency workers, as well as for their families and the families of suicide victims. Reverend Douglas, with the help of his wife, Carolyn, survivors of police suicide and friends, formed the National Police Suicide Foundation Incorporated, and they feel that many of these suicides occur because of the high stress level of law enforcement and emergency workers. The mission of the National Police Suicide Foundation is to provide suicide awareness and prevention training and support services that will meet the needs both psychologically and spiritually of emergency workers and their families. Thank you very much, Robert, for being here, and welcome.
Well, thank you, John. It's great to be here.
Let me just kick things off by asking you straight out, how pervasive is the problem of police suicide?
Okay. Well, according to our foundation, and you have to take into consideration, John, that this is an issue that the federal government has not necessarily publicly come out and said that we have a urgent issue of police suicide. So we have a lot of different professionals that are in this field, and among us, we have different opinions as to how serious the issue may be. But according to our foundation, the National Police Suicide Foundation, we believe a police officer commits suicide every 17 to 21 hours. You're looking, if you want to compare that with LODs, line of duty deaths, you'll see where on an average we lose an officer about every 56, 57 hours in the United States versus officers that die of self-inflicted wounds every 17 to 21 hours. So it is an alarming issue. I have no hesitation in calling it an epidemic that we have within our ranks, and is an issue that needs to be addressed immediately, right away.
Wow. Well, there may be a lot of other opinions out there, but you have the floor today, so this is all about what you believe,
yes, sir,
and I appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
You have been doing research now for a number of years. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe share with us some of this?
Well, yes, we can. I can give you one that I mentioned to you off the air just a moment ago that just came in. We've been doing, over the last couple of years, work with the Adler School of Psychology in Chicago, and that's under the direction of Dr. Victoria Sowick, if I pronounce that correctly. We have had the opportunity to be able just recently, and as recent as 2008, to survey 1,470 officers. I was able to do that when I was out on the road doing the suicide awareness training. And it was very interesting as to the results that we found. Some of it we were a little surprised by, some of them we were not. But what we were finding was that the most notable result of this survey, when talking to them and asking them about the issue of police suicide, do they recognize that it is an issue? How severe do you think the issue is? Do you know of people, other officers that have fantasized suicide? The most notable result of this study was that that 67% of that 1,470 officers surveyed talked about they had had suicidal thoughts and reported a link between domestic / relationship problems and their suicidal thoughts. And we wanted to know what brought that on, and how do they feel about that. One possible explanation we found in this study was it was an issue of power and control, John. And that doesn't surprise me so much because being a police officer for 25 years and serving in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam period, it was all about power and control. And we did that, part of it for survival skill, because we knew that we had to be able to take charge of a circumstance or a situation that we encountered, and we had to be able to follow through. And so the mindset that we had out on the street was of one very controlling, and we were one that we strive to make sure that our fellow officers did not get hurt, or ourselves, or our citizens in which we served. Now, that made us a tremendous officer, and in the Marine Corps, that made me a tremendous warrior. But the bottom line is that when we would go home, we found that we couldn't make the transition from the street to the home. And that was one thing that was really brought out in this study, okay, that we really live in two different worlds, okay? The inability to turn it off when we leave the job and to turn it back on when we go back to the job again. So this is something that I'm very excited about, and this is just a preliminary results of this this study that we did, but we'll be getting this out and publishing this through the Adler School of Psychology as soon as we possibly can.
That's excellent, and if you would make us aware of that, we would be happy to publicize that as well.
Oh, wonderful. Love to have you.
I'm kind of curious, in all of your research, is this a phenomenon that is just focused on street cops that have experienced some PTSD, or is this a little bit broader, more pervasive issue in law enforcement?
Well, if you're looking for research, you have to be looking at people like Dr. John Valenti out of the University of New York, Lou and Hatchett and many others that have done extensive work as far as the academic part. I guess the role that the National Police Suicide Foundation plays is one of really being on the line, basically. Our staff is out throughout the country. We do train-the-trainer programs that that teach other law enforcement trainers to be able to do what we do. But what we have found when doing this training, that predominantly the issue lies with line officers slash deputies, I guess we would define them. They are the ones that really seem to be experiencing the bulk of the trauma. The ones that commit suicide right behind them would be your first-line supervisors. But we have started to see over the years an increased number of administrators that are committing suicide. And we just had one up in New York State, if I'm not mistaken. And it is a very saddened thing. I had a situation where one actually, a chief called me, and he was in his office, and he was going to check out in there. He was going to kill himself right in the office, and I was speaking with him because of the pressures of the city government that he was dealing with at that particular time. But for the majority of the officers who commit suicide, the average of at least over 400 a year, they are very very much the line officer.
I don't know whether you know, have there been any studies done about what happens when the officer, you know, hangs up their uniform and turns in their badge? Is it affecting retired officers as well?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's correct. If you want to just step back for just a moment, you could look at the officers, for instance, that are hurt on the street, where you're looking at the general population running, according to the CDC, about 10 to 11 per 100,000. And then if you wish to take, let's say, the most conservative numbers as far as suicides that we have out there right now, running about 14 to 28 per 100,000. If you just want to take those, okay, the officers that are hurt in the line of duty and consequently cannot return and go out on a disability, their numbers, they start at 450 per 100,000, okay? And they can, I've seen them up as high as 1,200 100,000. So they really escalate, and I think the reason why that is true is because in our profession, this is not a job to us. It's not what we do as a form of employment. This unfortunately identifies who we are, not what we do. So when you look at retired officers, we see a spike between the first 5 years where they run about 200 per 100,000. So even after you get out of the profession and you've had a very successful career, you can see how it can still be very much of a danger. So, you know, the responsibility of law enforcement agencies then have to extend even after retirement. It's not just a matter of letting the officer retire and giving him a badge or her a badge and a nice certificate and some photographs and then saying, you know, enjoy your retirement years, because we still have a very heightened danger within that first 5 years of retirement.
You and I spoke briefly before, and I'd asked you, you know, is this an international phenomenon or is it something that only affects American law enforcement?
Yes, I believe it is an international issue, and here again, I don't have data on that as such, but I can tell you that last year I was contacted by the Turkish law enforcement over in Istanbul. They had contacted their officials in Washington and asked if I would come over and have some lunch with them and sit down and talk. They were having a world conference, and listen to this, John, a world conference of 68 law enforcement agencies from 68 different countries, and they had like three major issues that they wanted to really focus on, and one of the three was the issue of police suicide.
Wow.
So this gives me the indication that there may very well be an issue of suicide in other countries. I know I do interviews, and I was covered by McCall Magazine up in Canada on an issue of the escalating numbers of suicides in the Canadian areas and different different French provinces. So, you know, I don't have all the data on that, naturally, but I can surely tell you that I believe that it's not just exclusive to the United States.
Wow. Well, I think that's something that we as law enforcement officers need to address, and I'm not sure how best to do that, but I think we can talk about that a little bit. Before we talk about prevention, can we talk a little bit about causation? Has there been any research that points any fingers? Earlier you talked about domestic relationships. Is there research that shows us where to be looking, maybe for warning signs or what have you?
Well, absolutely. I guess the key of the whole thing is recognizing the risk factors, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And these turn into the causes why police officers commit suicide. Back in 1997, I conducted a basic survey. It was very elementary and probably professional clinical, researchers would maybe be a little critical of it, but I made it very, very basic only because I wanted to just get their gut response of the questions that I was going to ask. I had surveyed 500 police officers in 9 major cities. Now, this survey was published by the or placed in the FBI report in 2001 on suicide and law enforcement. I asked them if suicide was a viable option to them, and that's a key word now, John. If it was a viable option to them, what would cause them to kill themselves? And I got a 98% response. Now, with researches, you usually don't get anything that high. And here again, I could be under a lot of criticism for having something that high. But I had 500 cards, and I had 498 of them that were given back to me. And you should have seen these cards, what they wrote on the front and the back of them. It wasn't just the issue where they talked about the death of a child or a spouse. That happened to be the number one reason why they would commit suicide, but they mentioned issues of terminal illness. And terminal illness doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be under hospice care. It could be officers that are going through breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, skin cancer, just the, you know, the perception of this disease of cancer to them, and having some idea that this may take them off the line would be enough for them to check out. Okay, so they put down their terminal cancer. They talked about killing someone out of anger, and that's an interesting one because since 2004, we've been able to document at least 33 homicide suicides. I think Wisconsin last year had the highest number of people that officers killed, and an officer went into a party and there was a relationship issue going on, and he ended up returning and killing all six members of that party and then killing himself. And then Riverside County, California, I believe back in 2003 was the second worst one. So where he killed five members of his family, three children, a mother, a wife, and then he shot himself in the head. Okay. Mm. So you know, this homicide suicide is a major issue, and that goes into the issue of control. Goes in, you know, that type of issue. The fear and anticipation of arrest, the issue of feeling alone, they put down, the responsibility for a partner's death. I had a situation in Alabama where an Alabama state trooper had been killed in the line of duty 1 year to the anniversary, John, of that officer's death. His best friend committed suicide, and in his note, he wrote in there, if I would have been there, okay, Bill would not have died. Okay, so this issue of being responsible for the men and women in which you work with, and then issues such as sexual accusations, arrest, indictment, loss of job, and that's a big thing today too as well because of the economy and furloughs and the different issues that are going on. But the key here in this survey that we found was that they were saying, to me at least, and what I read, if I said to them, only if suicide is a viable option to you do you fill out this card. Otherwise, leave the card blank. John, I got 498 cards filled out, and this was from nine major cities, nine geographical locations in the country, and these officers, they were from all different agencies. So we had a very good number, you know, of officers and balance within our country. And so it says to me that suicide to law enforcement officers, and I know it sounds probably to the general public, it probably would sound a little crazy, but to us in law enforcement that have been in the field and have paid the dues, so to speak, suicide becomes very much of a viable option when we're trying to stop the pain, when we don't see another option. And we're not really ones to call out for help because we're here again. We're very concerned about the loss of the job because the job identifies who we are.
Yeah.
So the risk factors, and these are just a few of them that we must be very attuned to, especially first-line supervisors when dealing with the rank and file every single day.
You know, the personality profile of a police officer is an interesting thing. I guess that we are so prepared to deal with death that that our own doesn't impact us as much. I know when I was 20-something, I really didn't care how or when I died. I expected it would come soon, and it didn't really matter. You know, I guess that's the kind of profile you want for someone that's out there risking their lives. But at the same time, it sure creates this situation, and this is an interesting challenge to try to reverse.
Oh, it is. It very much so. I know in this recent survey that we did with Adler School of Psychology, 42% of those responding to that 1,470 officers, they went between the ages of 30 to 39, okay? These are, you know, just one of the profiles, predominantly male, which is not you know, unbelievable because of the disproportionate number of females that we have within our ranks. But we have also found now, at least we have found, that the method that the female officer uses is no different than the method of her counterpart. They will, out of about 89 to 90% of them that committed suicide last year, shot themselves in the head. That goes for males and females, and it was relationship issues. That was the number one reason why they were checking out. And it's very interesting too that they over 90% of them use their own service weapon. Now that's a very interesting thing. Now some of the researchers will naturally say it was the availability of the weapon. Okay, I don't know if that's necessarily true as far as I'm concerned, and I guess the reason why I believe that to be the case is that I truly believe that police officers actually plan out their suicides. I don't think they're what you would call impulsive acts necessarily, but they are acts that are planned out. We had a captain up in Massachusetts with the Massachusetts State Police that in actuality he planned out his suicide. He took out a whole life policy on his family, which he did not reveal to his wife 2 years prior to his suicide, and then committed suicide 2 weeks. It was 2 years and 2 weeks of the time that he took out that policy. He knew exactly what he was going to do, and I truly believe that, you know, our officers that commit suicide, for the most part, they do indeed plan out their suicides. I also believe, which I find very fascinating, is that in these situations that if you, you know, you ask the question, why do police officers commit suicide? Mm-hmm. Well, I truly believe that the why is found in the where.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The why is found in the where. We have found that the number one reason why police officers commit suicide is relationship issues. Guess where they kill themselves, John? They usually kill themselves at home in their bedrooms, okay? We had a LAPD narcotics officer killed herself just recently. She killed herself in the station house. Now, you know, we haven't we have no reason to believe that that was necessarily job related, but what we have found in the past, at least if the past gives us some, you know, insight into the present, what we have found is that where they kill themselves has a tremendous emphasis on the why. It could be interdepartmental issues, it could be punitive action, it could be any number of things. You know, so we thought that that kind of information can give us some insight as to how, you know, the administration and the first line supervisors, commanders that work the street, how they can start addressing this issue as far as managing of the men and women of our law enforcement agencies.
I just made myself a note a minute ago. I think you used the term warning signs or risk factors. Do you have a list of those?
Well, yes, I can give you just off the top of my head here. We find that there are three major risk factors that come into play, and that those are risk factors that deal with the agency, and that's one, okay? Mm-hmm. The agency may very well be what I just mentioned to you. It could be punitive action. It could be a transfer. We had an officer one time that he was a traffic officer, worked in a urban community, worked a particular intersection for 12 years, and for whatever reason, the commander took him off that intersection and put him somewhere else, and he committed suicide. Now, you say, well, that's ridiculous, but you know, to whatever was going on in his mind, he identified a great deal of his worth and value to where he was at that particular time. We have officers that have lost their dogs, canine officers that have committed suicide because they sent their dogs in and their dogs were killed in a shooting situation. It could be the most insignificant thing in the eyes of a commander when making a change to that officer, be it from patrol to traffic and traffic to CID or whatever the case may be. But whatever those circumstances are, they're always preferenced at least with the agency, their preference with what could possibly happen to my job if I do not comply, okay? And then you take that underlining issue of the officer identifying himself, herself, more with what they do than the position as a place of employment. You see the danger of it. Now, that's the agency, okay? The street is pretty probably pretty common. Something that you love to do. Law enforcement officers love to work the street. They love the action that is involved in getting involved in serving the community. Some of it can be very mundane. Others can be very, very, very heightened with stress and danger. Because of those circumstances, those tragedies that would come across their path, they will either suffer from what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, or they'll suffer from what we call CCTS, cumulative career trauma stress. Now, that PTSD is a ever-growing issue. I think Dr. Stephanie Samuels, who co-authored a book with Dr. Valenti not long ago called Under the Blue Shadow, talked about this. She was feeling like the numbers of PTSD were rising, where we were used to thinking it was around 20%. Now that number is going up to possibly as high as 40% on the issue of post-traumatic stress disorder. We're finding this also to be an ever-growing issue with our military as well.
Yeah.
The CCTS, that is an issue that it's just a matter, in some cases, putting on the uniform, going out on the street, just a routine patrols, gathered with it a certain degree of stress. And that's sort of a little bit of portions of issues that come into their life every single day. And they may not notice it as much as naturally as the PTSD, the acute issues, but then again, it still has a very severe impact on them. That would be your issues that they deal with as far as the street. It could be as serious as a domestic, or it could be a traffic stop. But however you look at it, I describe our officers as almost human landfills, and they're constantly dumping emotional issues into them. And we are told basically that we have to be strong and we have to keep it together, and we really are not to show emotions naturally in a circumstance because it could be interpreted the wrong way and we could lose control of what we're trying to accomplish. And all those things make a great deal of sense, except that we may not take the opportunity to dump that trash. And then if you're not careful over a period of years, and what we're finding here, within 11 or 12 years of such dumping emotionally, it could possibly lead to suicide. The third issue is relationship issues, and that's the home issues. And we're finding that our divorce ratio among officers are very high. Domestic violence ratio is double what the general population is. It is a very, very challenging time for our law enforcement families. A lot of that has to do with the lack of understanding on the part of the family many times as to what stresses their officer is going through. So people like John Valenti, for years now, Dr. Valenti, as I read his material, has recommended that we have spousal academies and really wanting to bring in families. And I tell you, I have started to recommend that more and more now, and wanting to make sure that families are involved in our training wherever I go. And we've got very, very good results. But those are the stresses that an officer deals with when he or she goes home. They do not always, you know, confide in their loved one about circumstances, naturally, that they deal with every day. And because of that, the loved one may not understand why they are moody or why they do not care to interact necessarily and go to different locations and places with family. Not that they don't in general, but you know what I'm saying. Their mind, their body may be there, but their mind is not there. Their mind is focusing on their job because in all practical purposes, they are like 24/7. They never seem to shut down. We're asking so much of our young men and women today in law enforcement because emotionally you're asking too much of them, too much.
I want to point out that we're at the bottom of the hour, and for all of those of you that are listening on the web page, there is a question box at the bottom of the page, and we welcome your questions. We're going to go until about 10 minutes after the top of the hour, and we'll save those questions up for the very last few minutes. So if you have questions that have come up while Robert is speaking, please type those in and click submit, and those will come to my desk onto my computer, and we will save those up for the very end. Robert, I'm kind of curious what you've seen around the nation or around the world. What are law enforcement agencies doing about this problem? What kind of steps are being taken, and how broad is that movement?
All right. We have right now, according to the FBI and the UCR, we have approximately 18,000 agencies in the United States, at least 18,000 that respond and filling out their reports to the UCR every single day. We're looking at 673,000 line officers / deputies. We're looking at another 100,000 federal agents and over 82 federal law enforcement agencies. I was just at FLETC down in Brunswick, Georgia, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, and they run through there. I had one say to me they run close to 60,000 federal agents through there a year. 60,000, and they represent over 82 federal law enforcement agencies. I had no idea that we had that many, but according to them, that's what we have. They, for instance, trying to be proactive, brought me down there to bring together their EAP and representatives, trainers from the different agencies, and we did our train-to-trainer program. They had experienced some suicides there of their students, and they were very concerned about that issue. Okay, so here we're starting to see an initial participation, and I think it's going to be a long-term relationship between federal law enforcement and wanting to address this issue. The FBI, I can't say enough good about the FBI and what they have done on this issue of police suicide. Going back to 2001, they put together a report of 790 pages exclusively on the issue of police suicide. This was a three-year study that was done throughout the United States. They brought together people like Dr. Valenti and Hackett and Lou and so many others to not only the academic field but also people within the field of law enforcement to look at this issue of police suicide, and they looked at it from every approach that you can possibly imagine in wanting to make sure that they got a true picture. That kind of emphasis has not stopped. There's a dear friend of mine, Samuel Feimster, Special Agent Feimster at the National Academy that teaches in the Behavioral Science Unit of the FBI. He has been studying and has underway right now a great project dealing with the issue of spirituality in law enforcement. He feels that the issue of spirituality is really the DNA of law enforcement officers. And we don't have enough time on this this program to talk about the different approaches that he's taking. But I will say to you right now, he believes, and I do too, and so does many others that have served on this committee to want to study this issue, that spirituality, even though there's a lot we do not understand about it, there's a lot that we can learn from it. And that's an approach that being taken by him and by the Bureau itself. I was yesterday with the command personnel of the Anne Arundel County Police and Anne Arundel County, Maryland here. Now, this is just one agency out of 18,000. But let me tell you, they over the years had experienced issues with police suicide. And when we had our annual conference several years ago here in Baltimore, their command personnel sent their trainers to our train-the-trainer program. Yesterday, it was quite an honor for me to be there because we had all the command personnel, and it was brought to my attention that starting this month, in the month of September, every law enforcement officer within the Anne Arundel County Police Department will be given at least 1 hour of suicide awareness training. Now, I know that's not a great deal, but let me just say this to you. Out of the 18,000 agencies that we have in the United States, to the best of our understanding, at least from the National Police Suicide Foundation's perspective, we are estimating less than 2% have any kind of PSA training at all, police suicide awareness training. So when you look at it in that perspective, this agency is very progressive. I was called today by the agency, their EAP, and they said to me that the recommendation that I had made yesterday to their command personnel about bringing in families and making sure that the officers are given blocks of instruction on communication skill with family members, wives, husbands, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, whatever the situation may be, they are going to put that in play, and that's going to be given to their officers as well. So when you start to see this kind of, you know, impact coming out, even though it is not as large as maybe we would like, it means an awful lot. I was on the phone this morning with a lady who is a president of a Catch a Falling Star Law Enforcement Assistance out of Lancaster, New York. Now, I personally had not heard of this organization, but it is what I'm finding out is doing wonderful work. Cindy Goss, who is the president of it, works with people like Dr. Valenti and others in the New York State area with their law enforcement officers, which naturally encompasses the city of New York, where you have 32,000 line officers in the city of New York. That's a wonderful organization. You know, this badge of life, I can't say enough about this. You should pull up their website. It puts mine to shame. It is beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful. And their approach is not just, have stuff on the website, but they are very committed in wanting to meet the needs of family members and law enforcement officers in this country on the issue of police suicide and how we can prevent it. The IACP now, in the last couple of years, has started to take the International Association of Chief Police taking a very aggressive approach in wanting to train their chiefs and administrators on the issue of just an awareness of police suicide awareness. And they're going to probably, I understand their next conference is coming up in Denver, Colorado, and one of our members and one of our lecturers is going to be there to give 2 hours of instruction on the issue of police suicide awareness to the IACP. So, you know, it's not like we're not doing anything. I think we're doing a lot. Yep. I think, though, that we're looking at we're looking at a culture which does not easily change. And it's going to take a great deal of time and effort to make sure that we bring about an awareness of this and trying to remove the stigma of it. That to me seems to be the big issue. If we can over time, and that's our long term goal, but if we can start to change the attitudes of how we look at officers that die of self-inflicted wounds. We have a tendency, if we're not careful, to look at them as being weak. Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true, because during Vietnam, 58,000 of our soldiers died in Vietnam. According to the Veterans Administration, up to 160,000 of these soldiers have committed suicide. Now, you look at our military today. The Pentagon just recently released that over 6,000 of our military soldiers have committed suicide versus, I think, around 5,500 possibly that have been killed in action. So this is, they call this, I think I read in USA Today recently, they call it the internal insurgency. I have a publication in front of me. I got it FLETC. It said here, returning war vets confront intense mental health disturbances. We're trying to bring about not an abnormality of this issue, but a normality of it, to understand that if you're going to be exposed to these issues that come across our path as vets or as law enforcement officers in this country, you're going to take a hit. And it's not abnormal. Now, this is just my professional opinion. It is not abnormal to fantasize suicide. It is very much of a normality to fantasize suicide. When you get to that point that you feel that there is no way out and the most valuable things in your life seem to be taken away, human beings, by mere nature of who we are, do not choose to live. Now, we can try to isolate it and say, you know, that's only those guys and girls over there, that's not us. But I'm going to tell you, and listen to me good, John, there's not a time that I do a lecture, and I'm in the field pretty much each year, there's not a time I do a lecture that I don't have an officer or maybe two or maybe three that have that are fantasizing suicide. I will take about 5 minutes at the beginning of my training, and I will say to the audience of law enforcement officers, I'd like to talk to you, to the ones that are thinking about killing themselves. And you could hear a pin drop in that room.
Yeah.
And I go into the issue of the hurt and the pain that they are feeling right now, and they just want to stop the pain. And I say to them, you know, listen to me good. When you kill yourself, when you put that gun to your head and you pull that trigger, you're not stopping your pain. All you're doing is transferring that pain to your wife or to your husband or to your mother or to your father, or to your fellow officers, to people that love you and care for you, okay? Suicide is not a way out. It causes more hurt and more pain. And I know that to some, as they might hear these words, think that this is a little bit of a draw, but I'm going to tell you, it is not. It is not. It is a very, very serious thing. I'm looking at a suicide note and getting ready for this this conference, this call, and this officer here was, and it's very short, it's not very long, but listen to what he says to his wife just before he had committed suicide. He said, "I love you." He's talking to his wife. He says, "I love you and the girls very much. Things with me have not been right, and work or with me. I'm downstairs in the tool room. I've shot myself. Do not come down. Just call 911 and take the girls out of the house. I'm sorry of any pain I have caused you. Please find someone nice." Now listen to this, John. "Please find someone nice. I will always be present in spirit. Kiss the girls every night for me. Love always, LT." And then he puts a little footnote at the bottom. He says, "The note I left on the counter for Amber," that was his daughter, "was so that she would not go looking for me." He didn't want his daughter coming home from school and seeing the car, the pickup truck there, and going around the house looking for Dad.
Right.
I mean, when you see that, you see the circumstances in which we are facing. Do we think that this officer is the exception, that it was just one that was weak or maybe one that could not take the pain? Well, I don't know if I would buy that. I think that each and every one of us as human beings have a limit to what we can take. And I also believe that it is a responsibility of the leadership of this country and the leadership of law enforcement, okay, to look at this issue and say, we have got ourselves a problem and we need to address this issue. And the best way to address it is education. Education is the key. I don't know if you wanted to get into that yet, but that is the key.
Well, the next question I had on my list was whether we have any model programs that you can mention. And,
yes, we do.
I think that's
yes,
a good
we do.
Segue.
I got two. I would love to mention to you. The
Please
first
do.
One is the Maryland State Police, right here in the state of Maryland. In 1995, David Mitchell, who was the superintendent of the Maryland State Police, we lost Trooper King. He was the first one in 1995, and I remember going to him and talking to him about this issue. And at that particular time, he was not totally receptive to what was going on. He felt that he was doing everything that he could naturally for the family, and so naturally that relationship was somewhat short. But over the next 4 years, or the next 3 years, I should say, he lost a trooper every year. In 1999. He contacted me back, and he said, I really need to talk to you. Can we sit down and look at this issue of police suicide within the Maryland State Police? And we did. I went out to Pikesville, sat down with him, and he allowed me to put a PSA model that we called a model at the time in place, and we did. It took about 3 months. We did five regional trainings in the state of Maryland throughout the state. And that took care of all the troopers. We did a change of curriculum in the education and training part, what the recruits would get when they come aboard. We did civilian employees and managers, people that work records, people that would see these troopers every single day. We made sure that they were made aware of this issue of police suicide. Now listen to this, John. That program was completed in the year 2000. Since the year 2000, they have had only one suicide, and that was, I think, in 2007, okay? But they have only had one. They had had four suicides between 1995 and 1999. Now, that's very significant to me. Okay. It says that when you have command personnel along with the rank and file, and especially along with the union, working together, there is no reason in this world why you cannot reduce the number of suicides in your organization. Now, the most recent success story that we feel is successful in this issue of PSA modeling was in California Highway Patrol, out there with under the badge of life, under that that organization, okay, out in California. The last quarter of 2005 and all of 2006, they had 13 suicides in 13 consecutive months. Okay, they had also 8 LODs during that period of time. So they had a considerable amount of loss. All right, Commissioner Brown was very concerned about the issue, and so was the state legislature and everybody else in the state of California because of the consistent numbers of California Highway Patrolmen that were committing suicide. The foundation, along with three other consultants, came out there. We did training. They put together a PSA model program. And I got a call from Commissioner Brown's office last year. And as of last year, unless something has changed within the last year, they have not had a suicide. So it's just like turning off a water spigot, okay? Wow. I truly believe that such programming and education and commitment, and that's the big thing, commitment on the part of management to want to address this issue can result in reducing the number of suicides that an agency is having or to prevent the possible suicides of officers in the future. So it works both ways. But the main thing is that leadership is what it's all about, and the leader has to acknowledge the fact that suicide is an issue. It doesn't mean that the leader himself has to fantasize suicide, but he has to understand that that is a probability within his organization, and that this kind of training, proactive training, instead of reactive training, can bring about a greater, a more healthier law enforcement officer in this country.
Well, I'm glad that you're making some inroads, and I'm proud to hear that some of those agencies are really taking the lead. You know, when I've talked about this issue in the past, it kind of comes down to what about the individual officers? What kind of recommendations do you have for individual officers who say, I want to make a difference, but, you know, my agency isn't really doing anything?
Well, I tell you, I'll sort of de-emphasize us for a moment and emphasize the many, many other organizations in this country that are trying to address this issue. You know, sometimes when you do these interviews, you have a tendency to want to push yourself a little bit and say, well, this is what we are doing. But I'm going to tell you something, and I take hits from from some of these organizations as well, but I'll tell you something. I have the greatest respect for organizations like the IACP that want to look at this issue. We have organizations like CALEA and POST, which are major certification boards for law enforcement officers. I think CALEA probably covers about, I'd say 60 to 70% of that 673,000, and maybe POST covers the balance. I have heard that they are now starting to take different segments of police suicide awareness training and placing that within the curriculum. I know in the state of Illinois that has started to really progress very rapidly. That's the reason why I'm doing my third train the trainer in the state of Illinois. I'm sorry, hold on. In the state of Illinois. So, you know, it's organizations like CALEA and POST and Badge of Life and John Valenti and so many, the University of New York, Columbia University, Duke University, I mean even Harvard University has worked with the IACP under securing a grant through the Joyce Foundation several years ago to make sure that the IACP was able to start this kind of programming. So when you start seeing that, it's very rewarding to me to see those circumstances going on, okay? And because with that kind of impact that you have, you'll find that that change is going to come about. It won't come about tomorrow, by no means, but it will in time. And that's why it's important that all of these organizations make sure that when you have young people that are very interested in this field, you have to encourage them. I have a young lady out of Oregon. Oh, yes, out of Oregon. Lindsay McQuizzen. She called me, and she was doing a paper on the issue of police suicide, and her professor said, that's ridiculous. There's no issue on police suicide. But she had pulled up the website and had found, that this was, you know, we get calls like you would not believe. Hold on for a second. She had pulled up the website and seen not just our organization but other organizations and dealing with the issue of police suicide, and she wanted to do something about it. So she contacted me about it, and I said, sure, I'd love to work with you on this. So I sent her some information. What I was so touched by was after she completed her paper and she finished the semester and everything, she sent me a copy of it. And she made one comment here that I thought was so good. It said, in her conclusion, agencies and citizens need to be part of the solution and no longer the problem. Family members ought to be included in the prevention training to identify officers at risk, risky behavior at home. Okay? I mean, it was a small little paragraph, but it brought home a very powerful point. Yeah. I had a young man who is a New Jersey State Trooper. His name is Trooper Orlando Ramos. What a fine young man. He heard me speak several years ago. He wanted to do his dissertation, his doctorate dissertation, on the issue of police suicide. And I said to him, that's going to be very challenging for you because, you know, the data collection and the numbers and all the other things. He said, no, I have a passion for this topic, and I need to address it. And so, by George, he did, and we did. I helped him do the survey nationwide, and he just got his doctorate degree about a year ago, and he called it a leadership perspective for understanding police suicide. His governor just appointed him to a commission to study the issue of police suicide in the state of New Jersey. Now, that commission has met. It has now got its end results. It is now aggressively wanting to implement PSA programming within law enforcement agencies in the state of New Jersey. You see what I'm talking about? When you're able to work with young people and you encourage mm-hmm. them and you say to them, you know, in my lifetime, I may not see this cultural change, but in the lifetime of Orlando Ramos, or maybe this young lady from Oregon, Lindsay, you know, in her lifetime, she may very well. So I'm very, very encouraged by that. So it's really it's a cooperative type of effort that we are seeing today by many people that have a passion for this topic. And I think in time we're going to see a major change, and officers' lives are going to be saved, and that to me is the key. You know, it's not a money thing, it's not a recognition thing, it's all about our police officers in this country and their families. With all our National Guard and many of our armed services personnel being over in another location and not necessarily here, a lot of our law enforcement officers are being deployed and they're coming back, yeah. and we're really needing to address this officer wellness issue, and to do that in such a way that will be healthy and these officers can live out their career and enjoy retirement. But if you've got an agency or an organization that doesn't want to even keep the possibility in mind that there could be a suicide issue within the organization, as long as they have this tendency to worry more about liability than they do about the officers that serve the men and women in our country today every single day and night, then, you know, it's going to make this program more challenging. But when we open our hearts and we open our minds and we start looking at this issue, you're going to start seeing that we can make a difference, and that every single day we can keep an officer from checking out just by the mere fact of changing the attitudes of how law enforcement agencies look at this issue. You know what we found here with this research, that our survey that was done and came back, that these officers are not going necessarily to their EAP. They're not going to their employee assistance. They're not going to their to their chaplain necessarily, or to their first line supervisors or peer support. You know, and you would like to think that they would, but you have to ask yourself this question: why are they not going to them? And I think the answer to that is the issue of trust. If law enforcement administrations don't have trust, then they have no power of influence and they have no opportunity to bring about change, because you're always going to be fighting and you're always going to be questioning the decisions in which they make. So trust plays a major role, and I don't want to paint all of our law enforcement administrators with a broad brush and saying they're all like that, because that's not true. You know, that, you know, they're Mr. what, Chief Goldstein out of Plymouth, Minnesota, that I was in not long ago. What a progressive young man, wanting to bring about a, you know, a real change in his agency, and he cares about those officers, and he's willing to step out of the norm and to look at this issue of police suicide, provide the training that is necessary, and because of that, we were fairly successful in what we did there in Minnesota. We have an organization by the name of SAVE in Minnesota that now is publishing 10,000 of these little cards that have the questions that you ask when an officer displays certain signs and symptoms. And Richard Peterson, who is our representative for the state of Minnesota, works on the board of this organization. He was able to get them to get these cards printed up, and now the SAVE organization and the National Police Suicide Foundation is going to work together in getting these this information out to the 10,000 officers in the state of Minnesota. Now, that's a small thing to a certain degree when you look at it from a national perspective or from a, you know, from a world perspective, but it is a beginning. It is a beginning, and that's what it's all about, John. It's all about just every single day, especially our individual officers, realizing that, you know, if their partner or if their wife or their husband or their son or their daughter is going through some of the risk factors that we mentioned, that if they see the signs and the symptoms and you know, all these organizations, Badge of Life and John Valenti and all of us would be more than happy to provide for them information on that if they would like to get that, then they need to be able to know how to handle that situation. And in doing so, may very well be instrumental in saving their best friend's life. So we're very excited about the work that's being done nationwide, and we're hoping that we'll be able to continue that as the months and the years go by.
Well, thank you, Robert. I want to remind everybody you're listening to Robert Douglas, the Executive Director of the National Police Suicide Foundation here in the United States. We have a whole slew of questions that have come in, so we're going to push on
good.
For another
10
minutes or so. Before we do that, I just want to make sure that everyone knows that they can learn more about your organization and reach you through your website at www.psf.org. That's PSF for Police Suicide Foundation.org. And I need to mention also that Robert has published two books, which I've had a chance to review, and they're outstanding. One of them entitled Death with No Valor, and the other one, Hope Beyond the Badge. Both excellent resources, and you can find those through the website for the Police Suicide Foundation. Also, they have a membership application there if you'd like to support what they're doing. But Robert, with your permission, I'm going to push on just a little bit, and I'll try to cluster some of these questions together. May I do that?
I'm excited. Yes, you do that.
Here's one that is particularly touching. What do you recommend to someone who knows an officer that is on a downward spiral, but you don't think they're suicidal yet? I don't want to interfere with his life, but what do you recommend?
Well, I think the most, it depends on that relationship, how the relationship is, but I think the most important thing is, you know, and this is not any, you know, comment against Dr. Phil. Dr. Phil's, the program is wonderful, and the man, I'm sure, is very wonderful, but the key here, you don't have to be a Dr. Phil, okay?
Yeah.
Matter of fact, it's really not so important, I would say, to that listener. It's not that important what they say, it's how they say it. Sometimes the mere touch of the hand on that person's shoulder or on that person's hand to show that you know somebody now sees that there is something going on in their life. It's a matter of instilling in that person that they have a great value to you, and I'm sure this listener. As they ask that question, it must be somebody close to them or someone that is important to them. It's important that they say to them, you know, how important they are, and that is there something that is pondering you or something on your mind that we can talk about. But the most important thing is that you show that you really do care. And if you progressively see that person sliding, that person may not be, you know, fantasizing suicide at this particular point, but if you get to the point where you see that they are almost getting to a point of clinical depression where they don't want to socialize, they don't want to eat, they don't want to get out of bed, then you have to get them immediate medical care. Just
Thank
be
you.
Yourself. That's the key. Show that you love them and care for them.
Thank you. Earlier you mentioned the issue of spirituality, and I've got two questions here that touch on both sides of that. The first one is, can faith in Jesus Christ help police officers on the issue of police suicide? And I have another one here that says, I'm not so very religious, but where can I find some peace of mind when it comes to things that I see on the streets every day?
Okay, very good. Both of those are good questions. The first one, as far as can people find peace in Jesus Christ? Well, yes, I firmly believe that. I mean, that is in my Christian perspective as a believer, I believe that to be the case, and that is true with me. But we have to understand that not everybody in this world is Christian. okay? Mm-hmm. We have a lot of different faiths and beliefs of different entities. And here again, since I am not the God and I'm not the judge, I would say that their faith, and I will say that to them, their faith, and going back to that faith and seeing what role that faith plays in their life is vital to them. So many times in our law enforcement ranks, if we're not careful, because of shift work, because of the issues that we deal with, we're not always taking advantage of the importance of our faith and worshiping on a weekly basis, or even on a daily basis for that reason, you know, that it is a tremendous supplement of care to us emotionally by doing that. For the person who is not what you would call religious, I really don't know if I always looked at religion as something made by man, so I'm not overly impressed by the issue of quote-unquote religion, having to have religion. But I believe it is very important to understand that even though you don't have infinite wisdom about how everything was created and how you got to this old world in the first place, you must understand, or at least have some basic concept, that there is of a higher being, a being that has a great love and care for you, that there is an answer that goes beyond what man may give you as far as a solution to an issue, and the finding of that relationship is entirely up to you in wanting to bring about, just like any other relationship. You got to have a desire and a will to do that. I know that it's so easy to be able to just make one blanket statement and feel like everybody fits into it, but I know, and so do the listeners, that the police officers and people that have been out in the street, I know that there are a lot of different beliefs and faiths that people have, but they need to strive to be in touch with that higher being, whatever that higher being may be to them now, because that's important. Maybe to me that's Jesus Christ, without a doubt, but maybe to them that may be something entirely different, okay? And I am not going to, you know, just try to make one size fits all. I mean, it's not that simplistic, okay? Mm-hmm. But if there's anything that they would need to do to be able to get in touch with a better understanding of who they are, it's going to make them healthier, and that is the key. I'm writing a book right now called The Art of Being You, and I think that is so important. I don't think we realize who we are, okay? Mm-hmm. I think we identify ourselves either with the job or with the profession or with what our father or our mother did, and that's what we do, and that's what we are. Well, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's necessarily true. And I'm hoping that in this book I'll be able to bring that out. Maybe that's not the best answer, but that's the one I have right now.
I appreciate that answer. I think we have time for one more, and this is a subject I probably is worthy of a whole separate program. But the question is, what about the families of the officers that commit suicide? Who helps them?
Ah, boy, that is such a good one. Well, I'll tell you what we're looking at right now. We're looking at literally thousands and thousands. And if you're looking at, let's say, 166 LODs, I'm just projecting a number here because I don't know the exact number of survivors. But if you're looking at 166 LODs, you might be looking at a base of maybe 1,500 survivors. It all depends on how you want to look at survivors, be them officers or whatever. If you're looking at suicide of law enforcement officers, and we're feeling those numbers are no less than 400 a year, okay, we're 402 that we had in 2008, then you're looking at least 2 to 3 times that number. Now, that's interesting. Maybe as many as 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 survivors a year that are not necessarily being taken care of. How do we bring that about? Well, what we try to do, and it's in a small way because we're, even as a national organization, we're in 31 states, but we're not in all the states yet, okay?
Yeah.
What we try to do is that when we hear that there is a suicide, we attempt to contact the family, either the state representative or the regional representative. If we can go over to see the family, if they're not really far away, because we have no money. Our organization is very limited. We have the most wonderful professional people working, but it's all, for the most part, very volunteer. If they can go over there to see the family, then they provide for them any kind of information, maybe a better understanding to a certain degree as to the issue of suicide. Of course, all this doesn't come the first day or the first week, but over a period of time, there's going to be a question as to you know, why would this happen? And not that we have all those answers, but we try very hard to meet their immediate needs. Our foundation does sponsor scholarship programs. Susie Sawyer with the COPS organization, she's such a blessing. She allowed me back in 1987 to start giving this little program at that time on police suicide awareness. And so it was through a lot of her work and a lot of her care and her organization that we were able to do what we do today. But here again, Susie is able to, and rightfully so, able to generate a fairly large number of dollars to make sure families are taken care of. Agencies take care of families. They make sure their kids go to college, you know, with scholarships, and they set up different kinds of things for them that makes life a little more bearable, even though they have lost their loved one in the line of duty. But in our side of that setting, that is not true. I talked to a chief the other day in the Midwest. I said, make sure that you do not cut this family's benefits off. Give them a little time. He said the city manager has already said to me, within 60 days their benefits will be cut. Many of our families do not get any kind of retirement package when their officer dies of self-inflicted wounds. And unfortunately, what happens here is that some of our families have turned around and, you know, sued the agency just to get their benefits. Mm-hmm. So it's just a very, very challenging thing. I would venture to say that any kind of revenues that could be generated to help our families in scholarships, immediate financial needs, it doesn't have to be to our foundation. It could be to any of these foundations that deal with families, okay, that you should donate to those organizations. I know our Signal 13, I was talking to the chairman of that just the other day at the hospital, and they're going to try to set up something where in the state of Maryland here, you know, Signal 13 revenues could possibly be used to help the families. Now, that hadn't been finalized, and that may not materialize. But it's nice to know that there are people in leadership roles that want to take care of our police families. Just because your loved one commits suicide doesn't mean you're no longer part of the family. But a lot of our survivors feel that their relationship has been severed when their husband dies. So there's a lot of education, John. There's a lot of things that need to be addressed to meet the needs of our families. And I think in due time, as we bring about this awareness, maybe those kinds of monies will be generated and we'll be able to address those issues.
Well, I certainly hope so. And Robert, I really want to thank you for all that you're doing and all the efforts that you're organizing, and certainly for being our guest here today. We will do our best to help, and by all means, let me know what COPS Alive can do to help you.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on and people, you know, having the opportunity to maybe say a few things that about this issue that maybe they didn't know, you know,
yeah,
going on
so.
In their lives.
I'm John Marks. You've been listening to a program produced by COPS Alive with Robert Douglas, the Executive Director of the National Police Suicide Foundation. And, Robert, we thank you very much. And we'll be back again with another one of these educational programs as soon as possible to help you and keep you safe and successful out there on the road and even beyond the job.
Thank you, John, and I wish the best for all of our listeners today. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Robert.